The five biggest stories.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story.
Five opinions.
Blah, blah, blah. Yada, yada, yada.
Each and every week.
That would be great.
This is the Intersection Podcast with Jason Page.
Fantastic.
Here's Jason.
Thank you so much, Chad Erickson. We welcome you back inside another episode of the Intersection Podcast. I am indeed the Jason Page. Another week. More conversation around American politics. We're not going to do politics every episode. In fact, I think after this week, chances are some of our guests will still have some sort of political angle to them. But I think we could officially start to move away from the 24/7 Donald Trump talk now that impeachment is officially over. And it is officially over. Trump was acquitted like we all knew he would be. You knew a few Republicans would come on board. You just didn't know how many. You wound up with seven, which is the number. I said between 5 and 10, which is, I thought a pretty safe bet. And it landed pretty much smack dab in the middle of that. You had seven Republicans vote to convict the president. And this is still the most bipartisan impeachment ever. So while Trump's taking a victory lap and going out to the golf course and hitting shots and all this stuff, the reality is he was still handed, I think, a pretty resounding message when you have the most bipartisan impeachment trial result to ever take place. 57 members of the Senate, not the 66 needed, but you still had, or 67 needed, but you still had 57 members of the United States Senate jump into the waters that are a little warmer and say, look, the guy's got to go. But look, ultimately, if you look at the headlines of impeachment and kind of try and paste that up on the wall next to some of the recent polling about where Trump stands in the Republican Party, you kind of start to wonder why more Republicans wouldn't be willing to peel away and peel off from Trump at this point. What is it that is keeping them so loyal to him when he has no loyalty to anybody but himself? It is the strangest, most symbiotic, just bizarre relationship, this parasitic relationship. There's these two parasitic relationships. One is between the mainstream Republican Party and Trump. You can't tell the difference between the two right now because there are so many of the people you thought were the mainstream of Republican Party, they're now in the Trump camp. Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, you name it. All of these people have kind of jumped up and said, you know, this is the Trump party. Lindsey Graham said, you know, Trump plus to win in 2022. And you wonder, and I heard Anthony Scaramucci mention this. I heard Anthony Scaramucci mention this on TV the other night. What does he have on them? I know it sounds cynical to say, well, he has to have something on him. Maybe he's got, you know, naked pictures of Lindsey Graham with, you know, some bellboy at a hotel that he stayed at, some Trump property he stayed at. No, really. At this point, you have to wonder why Lindsey Graham would keep tying his fortunes to a guy whose poll numbers are tanking nationally amongst all voters. Yes, the Republican Party still loves him, but they still don't love him to the tune that they were loving him when he was in office. Even that number has started to drop some. So what is it? What is it that keeps them so loyal? And then you start to get into this other conversation. And again, I saw Anthony Scaramucci bring this up the other night, not to quote him too many times, but this is something that I've been saying going back a year and a half. And that is the idea of a third party, a true conservative movement made up of Republicans that have basically walked away from the party because the party has, as it stands now, has walked away from them. And you start to wonder, does this start to gain more traction? There's conversation that by December, there could be a nominating party and, you know, all sorts of organizational paperwork could be done by December for this new conservative movement. Now, if you're the Democrats, who can manage to screw up a ham sandwich? If you're the Democrats, you just stand back and watch the food fight. Just stay out of your own way. Don't do or say anything stupid that's going to cause you to get in the way of the Republican implosion. There needs to be a viable second or third party in America. It can't just be the Democrats. You need competing ideas, because with competing ideas, you ultimately come to better ideas. So we need a viable alternative to the Democratic Party. Right now, that is not the Republican Party, which means something has to form out of the ashes of the smoldering mess that is the current Republican Party. You may not want to agree with that, but those are just the facts. I mean, the Republican Party in America right now is a laughingstock, which is something I talked about with our guest in today's episode of the Intersection Podcast. This week's episode is Matt Lewis. I love Matt. He is one of my very favorite conservatives to talk to. He has a long background in the Republican Party, and we talk about some of that in our conversation that you're getting in this episode. But he writes for the Daily Beast. He's a senior columnist there. You see him on all the networks. He's on with Bill Maher. He's on with Ryan Williams the other night. He used to be on with CNN all the time. He really is one of the best when it comes to breaking down the Republican Party and politics in general. And he's somebody I love to turn to whenever I get a chance. So the fact that I got to spend 25 minutes with him was something I felt really fortunate to have. So enjoy the conversation. Feel free to weigh in with your thoughts. You can leave us a comment on whatever podcasting platform you're hitting us up on. You can hit me up on Twitter at the back page as well. And I'll come back on the other side, have some more thoughts as well. But here's my conversation with Matt Lewis, senior columnist of the Daily Beast.
And now, the Intersection Interview.
Matt, you had seven Republicans join their Democratic colleagues in the Senate in voting for a conviction of Donald Trump in his impeachment trial. I'm of the mindset that it still needs to get worse for the GOP before it even starts to get better. Do you kind of feel the same way, or is this, have we reached the point now where the healing can begin?
Well, I mean, okay, so I'll start with the good news. This is actually the most bipartisan Senate impeachment trial in history, so something to be happy about. But having said that, I think it was a slam dunk. Donald Trump was obviously guilty and should have been convicted, and you got only seven Republicans. So not terribly encouraging from that perspective. And I think we're a long way from anything that would lead me to believe that they're going to change, right? Like, what would lead us to believe that they would change? They just lost a presidential election. Donald Trump lost the House and the Senate during his tenure. I think he single-handedly sabotaged Georgia, throwing the U.S. Senate to the Democrats. And yet they're now, oh, did I mention the insurrection that he caused and the fact that he's been impeached twice by the House? And yet there's no sign at all that they're ready to cut him loose or change. So I don't know why I would think that there's any, you know, that they've turned the corner yet.
All right. So if it needs to get worse, how much worse does it get? Does there need to be, you know, the way I look at it is every time there's been a potential off ramp for the party to get back into the right direction, no pun intended, they just continue down the same path towards this party destruction, where ultimately you're going to have, you know, the Trump wing of the party and normal conservatives and this battle for who can win those people in the middle. Is there a designated driver somewhere in their future that can get them on the right path?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, you're operating under the premise that people don't change until they have to. Altruism doesn't really matter, that it's you, when you hit rock bottom, you're forced to change. And I think that's probably a safe assumption, to be honest. But I just wanted to point it out. So based on your assumption, I think that they have to probably lose another presidential election. The problem is that because of the way that our system is set up, it is possible that Republicans could do all sorts of things wrong and make all sorts of mistakes and could still win the presidency by virtue of the Electoral College. I'm actually a fan of the Electoral College, but in this regard, if you're looking for something to shock you back into reality or back into good behavior, we are in a system where it's very possible, if not likely, the Republicans have very good midterm elections in 2 years, less than 2 years. And then it's certainly within the realm of possibility that you could win the presidency again with like 45% of the vote. And so I think it's going to take some losing for Republicans to really hit rock bottom and change their ways. But that may not happen anytime soon. It's sort of like they're being enabled, not just, I mean, there are enablers out there, including many in the U.S. Senate, who enabled Donald Trump's behavior. But the way that our electoral system is set up here in America, that I think is possibly enabling them to continue down this path for longer than they would if they had to win a majority of the vote.
See, I think the party has a fracture that can't be healed as long as Trump is able to run again in 2024. Like, even if he doesn't run, that specter is still lingering over the party. Is it only if he is convicted, you know, whether it be in Georgia or New York, of some crime and he's locked up, that then the party can shed him without fear?
So first of all, I don't even think that in and of itself automatically fixes things. A necessary ingredient, but not a sufficient ingredient. So it's possible that you could get rid of Donald Trump, and there would still be major problems in the Republican Party, including the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world and the Ted Cruzes of the world and this fight over who gets to be the next Trump, right? So just getting rid of Trump might not be enough, but it certainly is a necessary ingredient. And so I think what Republicans just guaranteed by failing to convict him in the Senate trial is that that necessary ingredient is not going to happen anytime soon. Trump will linger. We could hold out hope that there'll be some sort of legal action, but I have no, you know,
14th Amendment.
Cross your fingers.
14th Amendment?
I just feel like there's been talk of a lot of different possibilities. But if Donald Trump were prohibited from running for office again, that checks a box that might allow Republicans to start healing. I still think it's a long road, even if that were to happen, and I don't see it happening.
It'll continue to be a painful process. But is there any way outside of any of this, and maybe I'm overstating if I say that the party right now just completely lacks respectability, is there any other way for the party to get to a place of respectability as a whole without any of these things happening?
I don't think so. I think the fundamental problem is that the voters, the Republican voters, want what Trump gives them. And so it's really a demand problem. I mean, there is demand for what Trump is providing, and if Trump's not providing, someone else will. And so maybe we're lucky we had 7 Republicans who were brave enough to stand up. Maybe that's the way I should be looking at it instead of the glass 2/3 empty. It's a very serious fundamental problem that cannot be fixed by merely changing leaders at the top of the ticket.
It's kind of crazy to me because I think about what you said about, you know, what would scare them or what would set them straight is maybe losing in 2024. I mean, you would think Georgia and Arizona would scare them. You'd think even how close it is in Texas would be enough to scare them. Because let's be honest, if Texas goes blue, forget, they're not getting back. They're not getting back into the White House for a generation, Matt, if they can't win Texas. So even the path through the electoral map is getting more difficult for them. Georgia isn't an aberration. That is going to continue to be a 50-50 swing state. The same goes for Arizona because of the demographics in those places. You could gerrymander districts all you want. The reality is those states are now 50-50 toss-up states. So I just can't get over the idea. I can't get past the fact that knowing what you know about politics and what I know about politics, and that is this, Republicans are going to vote for Republicans. Even if Trump did, if they said, we're not doing anything with Trump anymore, screw him. If every senator had voted for impeachment, they said, we're done with him. At the end of the day, where are Republicans going to go? Like, they're not going to vote for other, they're not going to vote for Republicans in 2022 or in 2024? Of course they are. They always have. It's Democrats that sometimes don't get in line. Republicans get in line. So I don't understand why they didn't take yet another opportunity to shed him when they could.
Well, I agree they should have taken the opportunity to kick him while he was down. Because the idea that you can outlast this guy or wait him out or he's going to just go away, it never works, right? However, I'm not sure about the notion that Republicans would always vote Republican. I mean, I do think that there is some percent now of the Republican base. So what happened is the Republican Party made a conscious choice to get rid of people like me, by and large. You know, people who are college-educated suburbanites. The Republican Party got rid of us. And what they did was then they brought in people that used to be Democrats, the FDR coalition, these working class whites, you know, they brought them in. And those people may not vote Republican if Donald Trump is kicked to the curb. Like those, some of those people are probably are like Trump voters, uniquely Trump voters. And like the idea that they're going to go vote for Nikki Haley, I don't necessarily think that's true.
Talking with Matt Lewis.
So that's the problem. Yeah.
Matt Lewis, senior columnist over at the Daily Beast. By the way, I've been joking around about this for a week or so on the show. Am I crazy when I say Adam Kinzinger and Nikki Haley basically have already declared for 2024? When you look at what Kinzinger's doing with his PAC and Nikki Haley saying what she said about Trump, have they basically unofficially declared for 2024 already?
Yeah, and I would add a lot of people to the list, including, you know, Josh Hawley. I guess he said he's not running in 2024, but Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio. I mean, certainly Hawley was gonna run before the insurrection. He was definitely preparing for that. Maybe now he won't. Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, it's going to be a lot of people running. And I think they're being very transparent about it. But that's the other crazy thing is Donald Trump could Bigfoot all of them, you know? And so that's why I think there are two people that to me are the most interesting, and that's Tucker Carlson and Larry Hogan.
You really believe the Tucker Carlson thing, huh?
I think there's a 50 for, I think, first of all, I think there's a 50-50 chance he runs.
God.
50-50. So, and then second of all, if he runs, he could win. I mean, he would be very formidable.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and I worked for Tucker for 6 years, so I know Tucker very well. And,
do you still talk to him?
I text with him.
Oh, okay.
The last time I saw him was about, right before, I guess it was maybe January. So over a year ago, we had dinner in D.C. This is five of us. But I texted with him a few days ago. And I really like Tucker. We disagree on politics, obviously. But
I'm not going to lie. I went off on him on my show last week because the reality is what he said last week about George Floyd and how George Floyd died. It was basically because he was a drug addict. Like, come on, dude. Like,
I try not to watch him because I really like him a lot personally. I worked for him for 6 years and he was just a great boss. just a great boss. And like never anything but supportive. And the whole time he was paying me to write things that he totally disagrees with. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was never once like, don't write this or could you change that? So I have a certain loyalty to him personally, but our politics are not the same these days, certainly. We disagree very, very strongly about almost everything.
Do you ever text him? I mean, do you ever text him? Do you ever text him in a moment, you know, where maybe you just something he says hits you the wrong way and you just text him and say, dude, WTF? Like, I mean, do you ever have those moments or do you type it and then just delete it rather than sending it because you're afraid to kind of rub them the wrong way?
So it's funny, my friend, I don't know if you know my friend Jamie Weinstein, who has a great podcast. Jamie used to debate Tucker. Jamie worked with us at the Daily Caller for 6 years. He's a never Trump person as well. His wife, Michelle Fields, was the woman who, remember when Corey Lewandowski like pushed a reporter?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Scandal? Yeah.
That's Jamie's wife. So when Jamie and I worked at the Daily Caller together, Jamie would like get into arguments or debates with Tucker all the time. And they had, I think it was pretty, it got hot. You know what I mean? But they also both enjoyed it. But I don't really debate people. I just accept people for who they are. And I've never texted him and been like, this is insane, man. What are you thinking? Because I know it wouldn't work. It's not going to persuade him and it's going to hurt our friendship. Now, I have been asked, I was on CNN like a year ago, and Don Lemon asked me about something that Tucker said. And I said the caveat about how I like him personally. And then I said, I think what he's doing is insane. And then there was a big headline like in Mediaite or something like that. That was like, you know, former Daily Caller employee Tucker is insane, you know, something like that. So that's just how it gets played. You know, even if you preface it with all the, if he does run for president, which again, I put it like 50-50, and if I'm just putting my pundit hat on, I believe he would be very formidable. But if he runs, I'm going to have to like, I'm going to have to just tell him like, okay, you're in the political arena now, like as a candidate, and I write about politics. And so like right now, my job is not being a media commentator. But if he's running and I'm a political commentator, I'm going to have to commentate. So that's going to be how it goes, you know?
Hey, Matt, give me a thought on the Lincoln Project. It's going through all this turmoil right now. You've got people dropping like flies, walking away from it. Who knows if they survive all this? What do you make of the Lincoln Project right now?
Interesting. I don't know if it's done per se, but it's ugly, and I tell you, it's been this very interesting feeding frenzy. There were rumors for months about them. I mean, I was personally attacked by Steve Schmidt about 6 months ago, maybe 7-8 months ago this summer, where he compared me to a Vichy Nazi collaborator because I wasn't anti-Trump enough for him. So that's Steve Schmidt for you. How to win friends and influence people, Schmidt. And we've been hearing the rumors about Weaver, and like there was this weird thing that I watched develop just over the last month or two, where the mainstream media was avoiding covering the John Weaver story, the scandal. Nobody wanted to write about it. And then you saw somebody like at the American Conservative wrote about it, you know, and then it broke like in, I forget, it was like another, maybe a left of center alternative outlet. And then finally there was like a permission structure to start report. And then, you know, then now like in the last few days, there was like an AP story, a New York Times story, and like just revelations. And now there's like almost a feeding frenzy, even though you've got the impeachment as the backdrop and a lot of other craziness happening. So they're not in a good place. I've always felt like they were probably overrated. I think that the most important thing they did was psychological warfare. Like, I think they got in.
And that was important. That was important.
That is important. In terms of moving voters or persuading voters, I think the Republican voters against Trump were probably more effective in trying to target, like, you know, former Trump voters. But the question is, you know, for me, it's not just sort of the sex scandal, but like, how many millions of dollars did those guys pocket?
Yeah. And listen, Bill Maher even cornered Schmidt on that a bit and asked him, you know, as gently as he could. He didn't want to piss off the guy who's on his panel. But he basically said to him, all right, because Steve Schmidt's like, well, 63 to 67% went to voter turnout or, you know, getting the message out to voters. And Bill Maher's like, where's the rest of the money?
Yeah.
You know, and Steve Schmidt didn't really have an answer.
I'm not sure that that number is actually even right. But let's assume it is. You're still talking about a lot of money. They're raising tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
But Schmidt's an interesting career, right? So when he was, I think he was at the NRCC, and he had a reputation for having this just amazing temper, yelling at people, being very mean. He works for McCain. He basically picks Sarah Palin, which, look, I totally understood the decision to pick Sarah Palin at the time. And I think it's very defensible that they did that. But then what Schmidt did was what I don't respect, which is it used to be if you were like a political operative, you were like a rabbi. You were like a lawyer. You had almost attorney-client privilege. You don't then throw the client under the bus. And he did that to Palin. Now, I agree. Palin ended up radicalizing and inviting a lot. Yeah. She became horrible. But he was a professional. And so I sort of disagreed with that. But then remember, then he becomes like an MSNBC Republican, you know, telling the liberals everything they want to hear all the time. But then he goes to work for Howard Schultz, the Starbucks guy, making a lot of money, which pissed off the left because they were worried that Schultz would be a spoiler.
Sure.
And you know,
rightly so.
But then he did the Lincoln Project. So now he's back in the good graces of like the liberals. And now this. And it's just such an interesting story to see it play out.
Yeah, it certainly is. Last one. Let's, you know, you look at what voters are voting on. You know, these exit polls come out. Americans aren't voting on which party drives up the deficit. Yeah, the reality is most people can barely keep track of their own finances. They don't care what's going on. I have this conversation with older voters a lot of times where I'll say, well, what about Republicans and the deficit? They're like, I'm not even going to be alive. I'm not going to have to deal with it. I mean, that's sort of the mentality is, well, I'm not going to have to pay the bill. It won't be pretty in a 50-50 Senate. But Joe Biden can jam a lot of expensive propositions into law, whether it's, you know, his COVID relief bill, whether it's, you know, all these different things that Democrats have this pet list of projects they want to do. And if Americans get a whiff of what he wants to do and they like the scent, why wouldn't they buy in potentially to more of it?
Well, I think you're right. I'm somebody who thinks we ought to be concerned about the debt and the deficit. But it's really impossible to make that argument anymore because Donald Trump didn't care about it. He didn't want to do entitlement.
And neither did Mitch McConnell or anybody else.
Yeah, well, I think that they might have been, if you know, if Marco Rubio had won the presidency or something, you know, and you had Paul Ryan as the Speaker of the House, they might have actually done something to try to reform entitlements and rein in spending. But it's really hard to make the argument that now that spending is bad because it just looks so. I mean, I'm actually on the record. I wrote, you know, three or four columns during Trump's presidency dinging him for spending. And it was kind of hard to even write those three or four because there were a lot of other salacious scandals happening the whole time, right? That were more controversial. So I'm on the record as being consistent, worried about this. I mean, it just stands to reason that, like, at some point you have to pay your bills. And I mean, I think there's been a, there was a fear for a long time that we were going to have inflation or, you know, some sort of a recession. And it just, it didn't materialize. There wasn't, you know, Paul Ryan used to say, we have to tackle this or it's going to tackle us. It just never happened. So now I guess like the lesson we've learned is that there's no penalty, that deficits don't matter. Is, was it Dick Cheney who said that? I don't want to misquote him. I think it was Cheney, but whatever the case may be, there's really no disincentive for spending. Spending is popular. It's, it, it will stimulate the economy. It's going to happen. You, if you give people money, they're going to save some of it. They're going to spend some of it. So there's really no reason for Joe Biden not to do it. He doesn't even have a philosophical difference, opposition to it. On top of that, I think you could certainly make an argument if there was ever a time to spend money and to do a sort of a relief package, it would be during COVID when we, the government basically shut down businesses, right? This isn't the economy having a cyclical slowdown. I mean, this is the government shutting down businesses, you know? These aren't businesses that went out of business because they weren't providing a good product or meeting market demand or whatever. You know, we shut them down in many cases, or, you know. And so that's a long way of saying, yes, we're going to about to spend probably $1.9 trillion, maybe not quite that much, but it's not going to be the $600 billion that Republicans wanted as a trade-off.
Matt Lewis, senior columnist over at the Daily Beast, hosts a couple of podcasts there. Matt Lewis in the News and the DMZ Show. He is one of my very favorites to talk to. Tell Tucker I said hello, all right?
I will. I will. I'll text him and give him a shout out. It's been a week.
So. Stay safe back there in the States, all right?
You got it, man. Thank you.
Fascinating. Just absolutely fascinating. I mean, Tucker Carlson. That was my big wow moment. If you could have seen it on the Up Late with Jason Page video stream that we do, we did a video interview with Matt, so there was both audio and video. And when he blew out the Tucker Carlson line, my jaw nearly hit the floor. Because if the best the Republican Party has in back-to-back elections is Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson, you really do need to blow up the party. Because you are the party of, I mean, you're a clown car. You're a circus. If Tucker Carlson is the best you can do, it's going to be very interesting to watch over the coming weeks and months in 2022 and the midterms. And is there another party that sort of rises from the ashes? It's going to be very interesting to watch. But I always appreciate Matt Lewis, senior columnist over at the Daily Beast. Matt Lewis in the News is his podcast. That's also his Substack newsletter. He also co-hosts the DMZ podcast. He's busier than me, and that's hard to do. So thank you again to Matt for stopping by the program. And that is how we conclude this episode of the Intersection Podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. So you may have heard me talk about this daily video streaming show I do. Again, I mentioned it before. It's called Up Late with Jason Page. Well, I have good news. If you don't have time to watch the show each night, because it is on at 11 p.m. Eastern in the U.S., and that's, you know, some people are going to bed, but I figured we'd catch some of the nocturnal creatures. Well, soon, you'll be able to get a daily podcast of each night's show. That's right. The Up Late with Jason Page podcast from Believe is launching this week. Look for it on your favorite podcasting platform. We'll be on all of them. Apple Music, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, we're going to be on all of them. It's everything from our nightly show wrapped up in a big fat bow for you in a podcast each morning. Give it a listen on your way to work. We talk about politics, we talk about sports, entertainment, business, tech, you name it. We get into all of it. Of course, you can still watch the nightly show at 11 p.m. Eastern back in the U.S. That is 12 noon in Singapore. We're on Facebook Live, Twitch, YouTube, and Twitter. Subscribe to our intersecting media channels on those platforms as well. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Stay safe, mask up. You got to keep wearing the masks just a little while longer. We're almost through it. I'm Jason Page. I'll see you back here next week for the Intersection Podcast from Believe.